Hello, hello. Welcome, friends. Hopefully the live stream is coming through clear. Welcome, friends, to this is our third gathering in our Collective Intelligence event series, Exploring Tools for Wisdom. I am your host, Caroline, and I'm very, very honored to be joined today by Fabian, the co-founder of Napkin. So when I was planning this event series, Fabian, part of my deliciously fun work was that I was diving into the so-called Tools for Thought space, and I was trying out as many of the apps that I could get my paws on. And it was very early on in my relationship with Napkin. In fact, it was as early as the onboarding experience that I had when I was playing with the swarm of Naval thoughts. And very soon, in case you're wondering, swarm of thoughts, Fabian is going to show us exactly what we mean by that. But Napkin struck me as really quite special. And I knew that I wanted to talk with the creators for this event series. So I'm excited about this conversation for a lot of reasons. One is that I think we're going to get to explore some of the nuanced or the hidden aspects of human thinking and creativity, which I totally nerd out on. But I'm especially enthusiastic because I think leaning into the thesis of this event series, it's really about recognizing the power of technology, that depending on its particular framing or design, it can emphasize, it can even sort of institutionalize certain aspects of human nature and human capacities, with our other capacities either remaining latent or even atrophying from disuse. And this is a point that Brett Victor, who's an amazing user interface designer, has made very poignantly. So with events and conversations like this with friends like Fabian, my hope is that we can heed the call to become much more awake and alert in our role, not only as users, but ultimately as stewards and creators of technology. I think there are undreamt of degrees of freedom in human nature and therefore in the software that we can potentially create. So with that, again, my deep gratitude to Fabian, the co-founder of Napkin, for joining us. My friend, on our prep call yesterday, you had the brilliant idea that it would be good to first orient the audience, especially those who are watching us via video. And on the live stream, it may not be super clear, my friends, but if you go back after the recording is done, the quality should be much higher. It would be great for Fabian to give us a quick overview of Napkin. So we'll dive deep into this later on. But for now, Fabian, can you tell us briefly about Napkin? What is it? Who's using it? Why? And then let's do a little screen share. Again, we'll dive into this more deeply later on, but just a brief screen share so our friends can see what the UI of Napkin is.
Of course. Caroline, thanks a lot for having us here. It's really exciting. And the prep call has already been very thrilling. We touched so many topics, and I'm curious to touch them again today, kind of beauty and simplicity and all kinds of design and how we think and how we make sense of the world. But yeah, thanks. We go into the app first and have a look at that. And when we do, I will describe a little bit about what's happening and what we are seeing, so people who are not having the visual can all so relate a little bit and connect it to what we're going to talk about later. So you should see, here we go, perfect, a screen, which is your home screen if you have a Napkin account, and there's one note in the middle that's focused. And the whole interface that you're seeing here is our Swarm of Thought interface. That's what we invested a lot of time and energy and iteration on to build an interface that is great at showing connections between different thoughts. So every card is a unique insight, is an atomic node, some people would say. And when one card is focused in the middle, I'm seeing certain topics on that card, how the topics are getting there. We'll see more about that later. And I see other cards around that that are connected along the topics. And I can just move around. Whenever I focus a certain card, I am seeing more cards connected to that. And that gives me the possibility to just dive into that well of wisdom, move around, feel inspired by the connections I can make, and sometimes have those magic moments where something just clicks that I didn't see joined together before. And going in the real demo, I'm imagining I'm a very creative and curious person, and I'm imagining that in my day-to-day I'm coming across a lot of thoughts. Maybe I'm reading something, maybe I'm listening to podcasts, having good conversations, and I have my phone in my hand, so on my phone I'm just sharing a thought to my Napkin account. And when I do that, I don't have to be on my computer, obviously. It's just when I'm out on the road. But when I come back to my computer, I'm doing a little inbox review here. That's a very simple thing to do. It gets the thoughts that I've sent to my swarm of thoughts, to my napkin. And what you can also see is in the background, it looks at all my other thoughts, looks at the topics that I have in my other thoughts, and searches for connections. And that, for me, when I'm using that as a beauty, that I can come back and explore what other content I have in my swarm on some of the similar topics. I can adjust them, I can change them, and we can talk a little bit more maybe later about why do we use AI here, what's the advantage, what's the disadvantage. But staying with the tour, and then some of our users use it for mindset affirmation, for focusing on what they think is important. In the morning when they get up, they just spend a few minutes to cycle through the thoughts they didn't see in the longest time. There's a little spaced repetition algorithm in here, so you can just cycle through your thoughts. And what you can also do is when you are a creative who wants to build things, who wants to write articles, who wants to make movies, who is maybe a scientist, who is looking for the slow hunches that are leading to the new ideas, you can just drag the thoughts and drop them on one of your stacks. Stacks are static collections, while the swarm is always emerging, always changing, thinking when you're not there, exploring new stuff. And then when you are in those stacks, that's the last thing I would show on this one, you can make sections and you can drag them around, have a sequence, and then go to your writing tool or the other places where you're working with those thoughts again. So kind of last sentence, this one is not to work with your stuff that much, it's more about exploring it, about seeing the connections, and about being inspired.
Love it. Thank you. Thank you, Fabian, for taking us through that, my friend. The thing that I've struggled with, Fabian, in knowing how to describe napkin, I remember in the run-up to the event, I was trying to work with this, and I was like, okay, I'm using static graphics and images, but I need to make a brief video to demo the UI. And ultimately, I don't think that words can do the experience of napkin justice, but neither can a short video demo, because as we were saying yesterday, the magic really happens off screen. And this is not a tool for thought, but I think it'll make the point. Like with Instagram, it's very easy to describe. The magic is on the screen. Look at this filter. It's so easy to apply this filter to my photos. The lighting looks so warm and cozy. Yeah. And even like an app like Notion, look at the linked databases you can make. It's incredible for managing projects. Like it's a very quickly perceived benefit. But with Napkin, the magic is off screen. The software opens the door, so to speak, but the magic is happening internally. It's in the invisible connections, the ideas that are alighting in one's mind with the assistance of Napkin. And because we're exploring the realm of the mind, we have to acknowledge that a lot or the most magical aspects of our thought life are really mysterious. They're difficult to articulate in the sense of verbalizing through words. And I think Napkin's AI and user interface helps us to create encounters with our past thinking that have this quality of being serendipitous or unplanned. And the ideas that we discover, therefore, at least for me, they're often intuitions that just flash into my mind. It's a glimpse of some distant form. And it's very challenging for me to try to work that out in words. And I often have the sense, Fabian, that it's too early for me in the creative process to even try to fix the intuition in words. So something else that I wanted to indicate about what I think the magic of Napkin is, and forgive me, I have to apologize for this ahead of time. The analogy may be a bit weird to you, but just go with me on this. So one is using Napkin to collect and clip the ideas that one values. You can use the browser extension, like you said, you can grab thoughts from the web, you can manually type in your ideas. This means that we're already familiar with the ideas in Napkin, at least basically familiar before we even ever open the app. But what Napkin does is they take these discrete ideas that you're already familiar with and remixes them continually, so that what is familiar becomes new again. What is familiar becomes surprising in its novel presentation. And so the magic really here is like giving a completely new slant, giving a new perspective that a particular swarm of thoughts has given to me, has given to the concerns of my life, the questions that live within me that are maybe only half formed, only half known even to me. And when I was thinking about this and prepping for this interview, a beautiful quote by Alan Kay came to mind, and he said something like, we cannot see until we admit that we're blind. And he pointed out that human progress is about finding new ways to see things. In the last 400 years, he said, we've invented these powerful new apparatuses that are made up of powerful ideas that help us see the world in new ways. They can be sensory apparatus like telescopes, microscopes, reasoning apparatus like logic or math. But he said the most powerful factor, Fabian, is like the ability to change perspective. And he said it's this change in perspective on what it is we think we're perceiving that has helped us make more progress in the last 400 years than we ever have in the rest of human history. And he said, it's not taught in any school that I'm aware of. And so this change in perspective, I think, is profoundly fruitful. And I think it plays a key role in Napkin's magic. And I would venture to say that humanity dearly needs more of this capacity, this quality of finding wonder and surprise at the familiar. And this realization that nothing physical needs to change, not one atom of the physical needs to change. It's the same note that you made a month ago and a week ago, but merely now by changing one's perspective, the meaning changes, the whole world can shift for you in that moment. And I think it's so powerful. So this is leading up to like my, if I had to venture a description of Napkin, this is how I would do it. And I want to get your feedback on this. So with Napkin, you collect the thoughts that you value, and they're represented digitally in atomic cards. And Napkin uses natural language processing, NLP, to analyze your cards and to present related cards to you when you interact with it. And so here's the analogy that you may find weird. I think the Napkin UI is akin to doing a tarot card reading, except the tarot cards consist of the thoughts that you value, the ideas that you've collected, one idea, one thought per card. And similar to a tarot reading, you have the individual meaning of the single card, but then all the cards that show up in a spread also have to be read together as a whole. So each individual card, in addition to the single meaning, takes on new possibilities of meaning because of its proximity to, its interrelationship with the other cards in the swarm, as you call it, or the spread in my analogy. So there's this larger meaning, there's an emergent or potential meaning of the whole that comes first from this very particular constellation of cards that is being serendipitously shown to you by Napkin. And then the second source of this emergent or potential meaning of the whole comes from the fact that you are at a very unique place at the moment that you see and interact with these cards. It's a moment in time that will never be repeated. And I liken it to you having a favorite song or book. Every time you return to that favorite song or book, you glean a different meaning. Nothing physical has changed about that song or book. The lyrics are the same, the words are the same, but you yourself are different. And I find that this is a very concrete example of the emergent nature of consciousness in the life of the mind. And our relationship with our thoughts is like a dynamic onion, an infinite amount of layers to be peeled off, ever deepening in meaning. So each interaction with Napkin is like being shown a new tarot card spread. You can open it up, you can choose to browse through multiple swarms, a new tarot card spread, a new one, a new one, a new one, or you can rest and you can reflect on a single constellation of cards and see what emerges. And ultimately, by taking your collected thoughts and by forming and remixing them into different constellations or spreads, Napkin makes the familiar unfamiliar. And it's drawing out the superpower. It's helping us to discover new insights and new connections. So this is how I would, and it's not a very brief description, but this is how I would describe it. What do you think, my friend?
Very exciting. That is an analogy I haven't heard by now, and Napkin sparks a lot of analogies, I guess, because it's something new and different. But what I like about the analogy a lot is that I think if we want to speak for the position of tarot, that people who do tarot, they understand that the connections are more important than the entities themselves, and that even though language is linear, like we are always putting a logical argument on top of the other, reality isn't. Reality is very much interconnected, and reality is very much existing all at once. And even though language can't process that, our brains actually can quite well. And I think this is where we have to think about how do we build the tools that we are using, and how do we actually use them. If you want to be creative and you're at your desk and you have paper and pens, what do you do? Obviously, you are kind of writing notes, and then you're spreading them out and you're looking at all of them at once, you're moving them around. And then That gets a bit tedious if you are keeping that for a few months, because at some point your old kind of structure is not valid anymore and you have to resort, reshuffle. That's why all those mind maps and Miro pinboards are great for projects and for a short period of time. But if you want to build a well of wisdom from that for a longer period of time, they always erode with the changes in the reality that you are experiencing. And I think that if we think about that feeling of inspiration and that feeling of being creative, that is very close to what Kahneman and Tversky described in Thinking Fast and Slow, the system one and the system two thinking, where my system one is my system where I'm parallel processing everything all the time and I'm subconsciously super efficient in finding new angles at things and making small decisions. And it's also the system we're most creative with. It has biases, yes, but it is more creative. And if we want to find what you were describing as doing the interpretation of a spread and finding the new perspectives in there, we need our system one. And the funny thing is, if you are going to your computer and you're opening up the apps that you're usually using to work and to be creative, your brain is steered towards system two thinking massively, which is your rational thinking, which is your very binary and logical thinking, which is very thorough, but super tedious. And if you want to be creative, you better don't want to be super tedious. And that is, to me, it's fascinating that, I didn't really find many tools that try to nudge that try to nudge the brain in the direction of that parallel thinking, that fast thinking, that joyful thinking.
I love that. Thank you for wandering with me on that path. And I have that book on my bookshelf. I haven't gotten through it yet, but now you've given me that nudge. I'd love to shift gears now, my friend, and learn more about what brought you here to this point, to this work. Tell us a bit about your story, your background. We spoke briefly yesterday on a prep call, and even that amount of time, I could sense something really special about your perspective. You're striving to bring something very human-centered, humane, warm, balanced, artistic to the creation of software. What were like the major nodal points in your life that contributed to your unique perspective? Why do you value what you value? There's a lot in that question there.
And it's a big one, but it's an important one, because like people have to know where it comes from. And
yes,
all my life I've been super curious. I always wanted to find things out. And when you want to find things out, not necessarily as a scientist, but more a little bit in the direction of what other people might call wisdom, you are obviously reading a lot of books, you are talking to interesting people, and at some point, I felt like the most interesting people that are best at explaining what they do have a deep understanding of the connections, the associations, and the patterns in what they do. And to understand those patterns better, that are behind everything and that are repeating themselves in all the different disciplines, is something that is just thrilling me very much. And then when you think about those conversations that you've also had a lot in your life, they usually don't take place in boring places. They take place in beautiful places, and they take place in places that inspire and that are humane often. Mm-hmm. And while I'm not considering myself an artist, I like beauty and I like that feeling of something that when I look at it makes me want to spend more time there and makes me feel comfortable. And that is one motivation that went into there. And the other motivation of seeing people understand things and seeing that magic in their eyes when they have those breakpoints of really deeply understanding something makes me addicted. Like I just, when I see someone who has that feeling, it's the biggest spark of joy I can have. And I think that drove me to trying to build something that helps, because when you talk to those people, not all of them, but many of them, in their day-to-day, they appeared more overwhelmed to me, a little anxious, kind of so much information. What do I do with it? When I put it somewhere, how do I make use of it again? When I put it somewhere, is it going to be work for me in the end? If I send it to my Evernote, like if I look at that later, it looks like crap. Was it me? Probably like, okay, let's not look at it again. So I can kind of continue walking when I'm overwhelmed. Often people are opening social media and then they are trapped in an attention economy that is overwhelming their mind with more open loops, with more distractions. And that flaw in our information system design was something where it might be a bit over audacious or something, but where I thought maybe we try to build something that is mitigating this. And maybe for those people who are curious, who want to see the connections and who want to joyfully enjoy information and what they come across, let's build a space for them to thrive. And that is what Napkin aims to be. I mean, right now, obviously, it's early stage, but luckily already people are, quite a few, are sharing like their thoughts there and connecting them and working with it. And that is making me super grateful because it's a joy to work on that. And I think the most important influence is where, learning psychology, understanding that beauty works better, and the deep desire to make people who are curious thrive in a complex world.
Beautiful. Let's talk about Napkin's genesis. When did you launch Napkin? You've spoken about the context, the greater general context of your inspiration, but what was the specific inspiration?
I was building prototypes in this direction for a long time, for years, and always tinkering with it. But while I'm better at having like fancy ideas and building stuff that hasn't been there, I'm not that good at actually executing that and saying, okay, let's go, let's do that. And that is when David came into play, my co-founder, and on a few walks in the Swiss mountains, he was really curious about that idea. And then he said, let's go into that full time. Let's take all our savings, let's put them in this idea, and let's try to bring that to the world. And that was exciting, of course. It still is exciting. But it's definitely worth it, and it's definitely the right thing to do. And he really made it happen. Like, he was doing all the organizational stuff and getting things going. And also now he, like, the first contact with you was through David, because he is all over the world and talks to people and understands what their needs are. And then that allows us in the end to build that and to bring it to the world. And that was, I would say, the core point of its genesis. Early stages of that were very, looking back, weird prototypes. We thought a lot about how do we design the aesthetics of it? Do we put kind of abstracted visuals of horizons or clouds somewhere into the interface? We had snippets of text floating around the screen in all sizes and all kinds of blurriness. And sometimes while you were reading them, they were slowly drifting out of the screen, which was a bit frustrating because you couldn't get them back again. And our first users were very generous with us in giving us a lot of feedback and in understanding the vision and buying into the vision and helping us to bring it to a state where we always try to bridge usability and simplicity with that approach to aesthetics and to beauty. And we're not where we want to be yet, but on a good path, I'd say.
When did this happen, when you said, Eva, your co-founder turned to you and said, let's go all in, let's put all of our life savings in? And did it happen early on, before there was even a prototype? Did it happen when there was a prototype and you had heard something had come through with the user feedback that made it click for both of you, like, oh my God, it's working. This is needed in the world. Tell us a little bit about that magical moment. What spurred that decision to go all in?
Well, that's a great question, because looking back, it seems a bit irrational. When we decided to go all in, I had things that you can't really call a prototype. They were offline demos of something that could work in this direction, and they made people curious, but they were worlds away from actually being something that you can use in your day to day. And we really founded that on the premise of believing that this should come to the world. So no, there was no prototype yet. And that was last year. And then we built prototypes, tried to find users. And in the beginning of this year, in spring, we actually went live. And that was when, like, since then, like, the oldest users that we have were sometime around the turn of the year. Those were the really early pioneers, and then more and more came on board April, May, June, and since then it's quite okay, and since then it's also stable. Like, it's not like last year it was very shaky, this year it's stable and everything is working.
Wow. You were recently looking, I don't know if you're still looking for a third member of the founding team, the CTO, but in that job posting, you wrote, last year we built the beta, gained enough paying users to be cash flow positive, and the right partners to build a solid basis for the next steps. all bootstrapped, no VCs, complete freedom. This is so impressive that you accomplished this in such a short period of time. Can you tell us more about this? And how did you, tell us a little bit about your experience with approaching VCs, because I imagine some of the folks that are listening right now, they're also going all in on the space. They're building tools. They would love to know a little bit about how you've navigated this.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, we didn't have that plan from the beginning onwards, and I'm just going to be completely honest around that. When we started Napkin, we had that vision that is very close to what vision we have today, make more people in the world more inspired. What we also had in our head was kind of the startup cookbook. So we thought, okay, we are founding a startup, so what are the first steps? We have to do a pitch. So we discussed a lot about how does the pitch look like. Then we built a prototype, and then we were approaching VCs, and then we had VC calls, and that was super exciting, and we were talking to a lot of VCs, and they were talking to us, and they did a second and a third call, and they always told us whom else we still have to talk to. And that felt exciting for some period, and it's great sparring as well. I mean, VCs have a deep knowledge about what works and what doesn't, and great network mm-hmm. and everything. But we also felt that they are always pushing us in a direction that is more like closer to what already exists, maybe more scalable, maybe somehow easier to prove to work. And nobody explicitly said that, but when idealism is the driver and the motivation, I mean, I'm saying that myself, but I think if I'm a VC and I have one idealistic founder that wants to bring something to the world that isn't there yet, and that is probably going to be good for humanity if it exists, but doesn't really have a proof that it's going to make a lot of money very fast. Mm. Obviously, that's less attractive, and I don't blame them. And then we also didn't do that forever, because at the same time we had better and better feedback by users and got kind of small love letters about how it changes their life and everything, and that is really cool. And then it was a bit stubborn as well, but then we just said, okay, why don't we try to do it like that? And I'm very, very grateful, because then we found early users that were in a co-creation phase and that helped us to design the product. Like, we had very regular calls with them, and those were the innovators. Those were, in that period, short form nonfiction writers, so people who just have a tech blog and process a lot of information, and they often had setups with Roam or Obsidian or all the similar tools, which were cool setups, but for many of them they were too tedious and too mechanistic, and they were looking for something else, and that's why they helped us, and we tried to provide value for them as early as possible. And if a prototype isn't embarrassing, it's not a prototype, like a friend always said. So that was the start of it, and that was already live. And looking back, it was very rough, but only because of those people that were supporting it at the beginning, we could do that. And then the second base why we could continue doing it is, and that is maybe a tip for, I mean, I don't have statistics, but personally, I would do it the same again for other founders. If you're doing anything that people resonate with, that is having a reason and a purpose, and you have a pricing model on your homepage, put the believer plan on this one from the beginning, because half the revenues, roughly, came via the believer plans. And sometimes it were people that had a monthly plan and were paying monthly and then upgraded to the believer plan to support the vision and support our development. And sometimes it was also people that were randomly coming across our page and they liked it and they just left money there to support it, and they didn't want anything for that. And that is great, because it allows small startups to bootstrap that and then to only have the right incentives in the company, which is easier if you have to make your users happy and always long-term think about that and not in parallel think about other stakeholders that you have to do reports for that also have to be happy with their legitimate motivations. And thinking about recruiting, you mentioned it earlier. Definitely, like, we are a very small team, and it's cool, it works, but we are looking for one person at the moment, actually two roles. One more important role first, that's a kind of CTO role who will also, before we increase the team, build the mobile app. And that person should be someone who is not only a professional app developer and just likes to build apps, but also considers himself something maybe like an artist, something like a creator with a deep aspiration for aesthetics, because we want to bring something to the world that is not a more simple version of existing note-taking tools on the mobile app. It's also not the Swarm, obviously, because it needs a big screen, but it should be something that is, when you open it and you look at it, making you calm and relaxed immediately. And that is a lot about the movement, about the animations, the design. It might be like a computer game, actually. So maybe a game developer, don't know. And that would be the CTO role. And the other role is just developers, freelance front-end developers that want to work on making this more professional. And we have a lot of people that are like in the loose corners of the team. For example, Paul Brickman, who has worked a lot on the NLP and did a great job there, and other people like that who are just supporting this. And if anybody is curious about reaching out and having any idea that we don't even have ourselves, perfectly great. Just get in touch. Thanks for the time for this little recruitment pitch, Caroline.
No, of course, it's so important. I'm glad. I'm glad that you did that. I want to talk about, this is a concept that I read from Andy Matyshak. He wrote that UI is a public good. And he said, like, many tools for thought are public goods. They cost a lot to develop initially, and then it's super easy for other startups to come in, duplicate what you've done, and improve on them, essentially free riding on the investment of the earlier company. And he thought that this was why, essentially, that the space for tools for thought is essentially a public good and is underinvested in, because it's just not worth it for a startup to invest and to see someone else come along, take what they've done, and then iterate on that. Do you have concerns about that at all? Or is do you feel like, first of all, you describe an incredibly engaged community that you said working in nonfiction, writing tech blogs, clearly there's the serious context of use where they're engaged, working with you very intimately. You are building things to satisfy their desire for what they need. So that seems like, quote unquote, a competitive moat. But do you ever think about that? And are you sort of putting any sort of contingencies into place to ensure that there is enough of a distance there in terms of someone coming in and perhaps taking what looks to be a very simple UI experience and taking that and running with it?
First, I love what Andy does. He's a great guy, and we had small discussions in the process of Napkin as well, and we need more people that are trying to get that deeper understanding in the area we're talking about. Then on the possibility of other people building something similar, I think if you build software, that is just part of the game. It's not great, but it is somehow part of the game. And does it affect our thinking and how we are working on Napkin? I wouldn't say so much. I think if you don't give trust in the world, it's basically impossible to get trust back. So you have to give that credit first, and then you have to keep moving, and then you have to trust in the world that it's going to work out in the end. Can it go wrong? Yes, of course it can go wrong. Like, if Apple decides tomorrow that they want to build something very similar right into their Notes app, then we are going to have a small party, and maybe we'll continue, maybe we'll do something else, maybe we won't. That nobody knows, but that's I think that's entrepreneurship. And I also think that the motivation of those people is interesting. I think if somebody is motivated to bring that to the world, to help as many people as possible, and at the beginning, she or he knows apps that are already doing that, it's probable that they are reaching out. Because, I mean, we're totally open for anyone who wants to work on that as well. If somebody wants to earn a lot of money with a new kind of app, then he might also find a better way to order food, I don't know, or like do any of the things that you can do to earn a lot of money. And I don't think that Napkin is in that space yet. And therefore, we just continue doing it and be happy with it. And we are also quite open with why we design stuff and how we design it, because I think it's important to be transparent about that, so the users feel safe and they get the incentives and everything. I think that's fine.
I would love, Fabian, to dig into multiplayer mode, because so thus far what you've shown us is what it looks like in single player mode. And when I first got in contact with you, I was like, oh, can I test out the multiplayer mode? And you relayed to me that you had earlier released something, but there were issues with it. Can you tell us a little bit about your vision? What's in store? What's your vision for multiplayer mode? What does Napkin have to say about collective intelligence? Maybe even a sneak peek, if that's possible. I don't know.
The target of Napkin is first to make more people more inspired, like I said earlier, and that is possible if you are providing them with a beautiful and simple space to think. And then it has an extra potential, which can get very big if you are allowing people to share thoughts. And when we talk about that internally, we use a term that we call medium of thought, because we think that there are a lot of mediums of information. Like we have loads of mediums to share information, to store information. But what is thought? Thought is not that linear sequence of words. Thought is also not a picture. Thought might be connected insights. And I think Napkin is not exactly thought, obviously. That's only in our heads. But Napkin is closer to that. And then, can we build a medium of thought? Can we share thoughts with other people? And if I share a thought with you, like let's say we are preparing that, call, and you have topics that you think we could talk about, and you're sharing a few thoughts with me, I am opening them, and immediately around them I see connected my own thoughts. That is obviously a great way to share this level of information. Mm-hmm. And that is also probably easier for you or me to build knowledge, because knowledge is when we are connecting those things into our own pre-existing knowledge, obviously, and then that's easier again if I have the associations to stuff where I already have an emotion on. And that is why we are very curious about multiplayer mode. Multiplayer mode also is adding a level of complexity, because if you're a new user, what is Napkin then? Like, is it a space for you to think and be creative? Is it a content provider? Like, is it very close to a library that is providing insight? Or, like, what is it then? And it's surprisingly hard, at least for us, maybe not for others, but to build something that is not there. Like, we can't say Napkin is just like this, but better. Napkin is somehow different. And you have to get that across to the people and help them find in that future. And when we were adding public napkins, it was even in a quite early phase of Napkin in late spring, that was just the confusing thing to have all those links and those connections. And then also if you're adding tags to a thought from another person, if you are editing a thought from another person, creating a copy in your own version, connecting it to the original thought, using another person's thought in one of your articles, and then the other person is editing the thought because they have a better insight on that, and then your article is kind of warped because you're like, what, did I put that there? That doesn't fit in the sequence. Like, that was just a lot of interesting things to solve. But then we said, okay, let's make it a bit easier. And a sneak preview, like, people who are on Napkin's mailing list, and also the ones who are getting on it, they sometimes get little summaries of books that we think are inspiring, and then you can open them if you have an account, and you can save thoughts. And that is a first precursor where we're also trying how are people interacting with it, and how are we going to build on that.
I love that feature, by the way. Absolutely love it. You've written, Fabian, about you launched Napkin to essentially take this issue of better thinking beyond the existing niche of note-taking apps and really intensive, like, PKM practices. And in explaining why we're so focused on the note-taking, you said it's really easy to be focused on, like, the material, the visible part of this relationship that we have with our thought life, the artifacts of the notes. Mm-hmm. But there's this invisible psychological process of actually generating insights and creativity that is much more difficult to wrap our arms around. And you said that Napkin is focused on the more utilitarian questions of note-taking and utility, but also the list of hard problems, and you said it's an incomplete list. So I would love to tackle a few of these in turn. I think the first one was how to be more inspired in day-to-day life. And you told me yesterday that Napkin is not aimed at being better at sense-making, but to enjoy life, to enjoy curiosity. Mm-hmm. And my first question, how do you think of sense-making? Because when you say it's not aimed at being better at sense-making, but to enjoy life, I think, to me, and again, this is just my perspective, sense-making isn't just intellectual activity. It's broadly meaning-making, which to me is perhaps the ultimate joy of life. So what do you mean when you say Napkin is not aimed at being better at sense-making, but to enjoy life and to enjoy curiosity?
That's a great question, because it's a hard question at the beginning. You can't put that on your homepage. At least we didn't find a good way to do it. But once you are experiencing it, you are getting those love letters from users, because they can't really say why, but they have that feeling. And one of our users, luckily, is a neuroscientist, and we discussed it with her. So here's the summary of what I still have in my head. and it's very, very down to earth. It's actually immensely simple in the end, I think. If you are walking around in the world and you are getting input into your brain, I'm talking very mechanistic here, sorry for that. Those things are causing open loops in your brain, and they are asking your brain to somehow process them, if you are giving them some kind of value or emotion, because then your brain is pondering, meandering, and trying to work on this. Then if you have too many of those open loops, they somehow get stuck, get clogged, and your brain, your subconsciousness is just a bit overwhelmed with processing all of that. And that makes your brain consume more energy on a very basic level. And your brain is also getting less coherent, also on a very basic level, because you just have all those irritations and changes, and every irritation is the start of a learning process. But if you are pushing them away, they are kind of getting bigger and at some point taking more energy, because if you are used to not thinking about that, it gets even easier to not think about that, and then you get more overwhelmed and maybe or more anxious because you're not processing that stuff and not using it, and it's always coming back. And if you fix this problem by putting every thought that resonates with you, that you think is important, in a safe place, I mean, that is a very simple methodology from many, many other books and processes as well. You first know it is somewhere, but that is only a very, very first step. So when you have one of those thoughts that resonates with you, maybe cycles back, you send it to your swarm of thoughts. Then on a regular rhythm, maybe in your daily routine, you are going into your swarm of thoughts and you are opening one of those small playlists where it just gives you a small sequence of thoughts. And when you're looking at them, you see the connections to the other thoughts, which again is crazy simple, but if it helps your brain to build an association to another thought that you already have on your brain, mm-hmm. and that you have a maybe more solidified opinion on, it allows you to process that open loop. And that in the end is also, again, breaking it down to the energy level, more efficient for your brain, because your brain is going to be more coherent and more connected, and it's easier to get from A to B along the associations that you have just built. And that is then what I think a more enjoyable way of interacting with our information. And it's very close to sense making. Sense making, in my opinion, is understanding the world, and I gain understanding by getting those perspectives on the thoughts that I resonate with, that somehow irritate me. And sense making, of course, is also to know what to do next. And that process of to know what to do is something that is easier if you are more relaxed, because you are kind of more chill, your brain is better connected. But it then is something that is more going to do, okay, what's the to-do? What's the action that I do now? And that is something, just to be clear, it's not happening in napkin, like we're not a to-do list, but it's easier to say, okay, this is taken care of, let's leave it there, and this is something else where I still want to think about more.
I love that. Yeah, I remember reading that interview with Dr. Xu. I loved how she laid that out for us. One thought that I had during my recent conversation with the founder of Arena, Charles Bisgoski, was that it's become more difficult for a person to cultivate what is called metaphoric perception. And I think you can kind of see empirical evidence for this and how far poetry has fallen out of favor in the general population. So I think you can... Actually, I think you can also see this in how polarized we've become socially and politically, but maybe this is a harder sell. But in the context of Arena, I don't know if you're familiar with Arena, metaphoric perception is cultivated by helping the user of the software bring two disparate things together. And the fact of this togetherness, the equivalency of two disparate things, will help ease the mind into a state of high creative tension. And it kicks into like a nonverbal mode of cognition that is deeply rich and creative. And this is essentially what happens when we perceive the meaning of a metaphor. It can't be done with the logical verbal aspect of the mind. And this interview that you did with Dr. Xu, where she was recommending ways that we can cultivate these aha experiences, she said very beautiful things. She said, you need to wander around your information. You need to play with it before you even begin to try to structure it. And then she said something really, really powerful. She recommended looking at opposites together. How can these be alike? How can these be related? Or even thinking about improbable connections. And I think that this is getting at the essence of what I'm calling metaphoric perception, putting two disparate, contradictory things together and finding that relationship. Our logical mind may perceive opposites, but the nonverbal aspect of our intelligence is actually attuned to the ultimate wholeness of all things and can actually perceive relatedness. So this next question, Fabian, is about the AI, the NLP. natural language processing, which is the development of algorithms and models that can analyze and understand human language. So NLP plays a major role in Napkin, and I have a very rudimentary understanding of this, so bear with. I can't help but wonder if an NLP model that is perhaps scanning for same or similar words or interpreting proximate words in context for same or similar meaning will tend towards finding relationships that are far too literal and therefore ignore arguably the richest arena of meaning, which is metaphoric perception, metaphoric meaning. And when I think about this, I love this tweet by Paul Graham back in 2020. He said, "You're in very promising territory when two ideas you thought were unrelated turn out to be the same. When this happens, pay attention." So again, he's talking about metaphoric perception. How do you think about this, Fabian? What are some of the key challenges that you've encountered in working with NLP, in deploying the NLP model in the context of Napkin, where you are trying to cultivate these aha experiences? Can you dig into that for us?
That's a very good question, because it's connecting so many levels. First, you were starting with a level of poetic thinking, and I think that poetic thinking and speaking is great at holding an ambiguity, and holding that space of ambiguity that we need to give our brain the chance to bubble up the insight from system one to system two. If we are too fast in actually speaking in very linear ways and speaking in very simple ways, we are losing that capability. And I wonder why it's falling back in public perception. I have the same feeling as you have, that it's kind of less popular. And maybe it is why it's because we are afraid of insecurity, and maybe it's kind of fleeing in the wrong way, because we want more safety, we want more orientation, we want more security, and then we are afraid to accept insecurity, and that is very close to holding the space of poetic speaking and poetic thinking, and that is where we try to give a space to do that. And when we had that discussion with Karen Hsu, she was touching a lot of those topics, and she wrote a book about it as well. It's great, and it's definitely worth reading. And what we want to continue doing is make more space for that, to have those connections. And we use NLP and AI because we think that when you yourself are adding the tags manually, that has the disadvantage that it's framed by your ideas. I mean, your ideas are great. Everybody's ideas are great, but they are always primed by what we have learned before. And if I'm reading a text about spiritual thinking, and I'm then listening to a project management podcast, I would never have the idea to put tags that are connecting those two topics with each other. But an AI is more neutral. An AI is just looking at that. And it's like, okay, like, I don't have your prejudice. I don't have all those ideas on top of that. I just see there's a connection. So I'm adding the tag that is connecting it. And you can still delete it. Like, it's just kind of a second opinion that is trying to spark your inspiration. And we were exploring different ways how to do that. And we are currently aiming at a way that is always connecting a new thought to any existing thought, even if it's a bit far away. Like, if you're exploring a new field with your Napkin account, at the beginning of exploring the new field, there are a bit far-fetched connections to existing stuff, but that is because still it's easier to build on something that is already there. And then always when there is not a perfect fit with something that is already existing, which might also say, hey, this is boring, then we are adding topics that are new. And the topics that are new are sometimes a bit abstract, and sometimes they are opening ways of interpretation as well. For example, I was adding something on... I think it was on strategy and startups, and then it added Kaikaku philosophy model, and then it was like, okay, cool, I never like really thought about that, but this is connected. And is AI good in that level of poetic thinking and holding the ambiguity is a great question, where I would have some discussion with Paul. Like, he is working along those lines because he's also thinking in how can we get a deeper understanding of cultural evolution and decision making with AI by making small agents that are interacting with each other and then observing them and building a model for cultural evolution. And we will probably, it would be cool to take some of that into Napkin as well and to always be at that forefront of doing the transfer in a very high level of AI into a very simple and accessible tool.
Mm.
That is not in there yet, like not making the wrong promise, but it is something that we are aiming to do.
Love it. Love it. Thank you, Fabian, for that. I think it was on your website that I saw, maybe it's not your motto, but it was this saying that you had written, collect ideas, seek connections, and free your mind. And there's this primal psychological drive behind collecting, which I see very clearly in Web3, NFTs, and also in many of the note-taking apps, right? And as Andy has written before, collecting materials feels so much more useful than it actually is.
Yes.
He says, accumulating tabs, saving PDFs, and making bookmarks feels like progress, but we systematically overrate its value. We collect material because it's easy and because it quells the anxiety that we'll never find what we're looking at again. But really, we're often just making things worse, burying important materials in tons of secondary matter that we just don't want to lose. So Fabian, Tyler Cowen, the economist, he also said something really lovely about the impulse to collecting. On the one hand, he said, collecting is deeply human. It's a joyful and pleasurable form of mental ordering. It's about what I value. It's about what gives me meaning, life meaning for me. Yet, Cowen said, the danger is that we overfixate on what he termed, quote, programs of completion. Cowen said we need to cultivate freedom from stories of completion and wander in new directions. So it seems to me like there's this balance, as there often is in life. It's like we take pleasure in collecting. We come across a quote, we want to throw it into our napkin. It gives us joy, but we want to take care that that's not just all that we're doing. Just throwing stuff into napkin. There has to be something else that allows us to free ourselves from not just the stories of completion, but I think to also to begin to metabolize those thoughts, which is what I think Andy is getting at the point of doing. How do you think about this, whether personally or professionally? How do you think Napkin can help us steer our way through? I think one aspect of the UI that is quite beautiful and subtle is the fact that it feels best if you are really making your notes as succinct as possible. So it's the UI is telling you, metabolize. I mean, you can click and you can see the whole thing, but then the flow through the playlist is just not going to feel as good. So tell us about how you think about this.
Yeah, that's top three user feedback. Can you make the notes longer, please? And then I'm always thinking this
question. Really, like,
I mean, we have like top three. It's not the top one, but it's very often. And it's often when people come in and have some unlearning to do, when they feel like the longer the better, the more the better, and then also kind of the more fixed and the more hierarchical the better, and then they have unlearning in the direction of we don't need so much structure and also we don't need so much stuff. And like making it clear and simple is, if somebody wants to collect something, let's give them the possibility, because if it feels better, why not doing it? But also let's not nudge them towards collecting more. That's why on Napkin's interface, you don't really see how many thoughts you have. You don't really get a feedback on, hey, cool, you collected 10 more or something. We're never going to do it like that. And we are also always going to keep the amount of thoughts you see at once at a limited level, so you are not overwhelmed by whatever you are collecting in there. And of course, the thinking, that is something that we are going to do in our head. But it would also be a waste to say we are not allowing tools to help us thinking. Like sometimes we hear people talking about commonplace books and about Zettelkasten and stuff like that. And they were created in times where they were limited by physical constraints, and we should use digitalization to make it easier to do those collections and then to enjoy them. And I love the metaphor of digital gardening a lot. Like Maggie Appleton is great on that, and others as well. And that is something that I think is close to Napkin's mind as well, to build your little Zen garden of ideas and to then enjoy them and to allow systems to help you with that if you want to, but also to do the thinking on the stuff and do it more enjoyable.
We don't have too much time left, my friend, so I want to steer to the conversation of beauty, which I don't want to say goodbye to you without at least touching on. You said something very lovely yesterday that with Napkin, your aim is to build a beautiful work of art. I love hearing this in the context of software and specifically this space, which is concerned with supporting human thinking and creativity. And you said, Fabian, that there is a misconception in software design. You referenced a design studio. I think it was Stefan Sagmeister, correct me if I'm wrong, but whose design studio produced research on beauty and its declining presence in our life. Can you, first, can you give us some context into this research, which is absolutely fascinating? It kind of affirms an intuition that I've had for a long time that I've equated with the loss of meaning. The more that meaning drains from our life, the less that we can feel like we can speak or relate or even have an intuition of beauty and its purpose. So Fabian, what's the misconception in software design? How do you see beauty or the lack of it playing into the online world, the world of software, where a lot of what's being created is by like a functional engineering mindset?
Well, thanks for bringing those bold statements to the podcast. I wouldn't have repeated them in public, but I obviously still like them. I'm not sure all of them are true, but they are a working premise for what we do. And what Sagmeister, and that is true, is doing, like, he is great at breaking things down in a simple way. And one thing that he broke down in a simple way was he just looked at the volumes of writing that humanity produces. And they did an analysis in there over the centuries of how often does the word beauty or similar words appear in our writing. And the word beauty was appearing a lot and more until industrialization. And then when we were turning towards more efficiency and towards more standard processes, it was vanishing from the published volumes that humanity is producing. So also, in a way, what we are focusing on. And then he has something else that is also around the term beauty. He says that beauty actually is function, that beautiful things do work better. And for me at the beginning, it was a bit hard to grasp, but I don't know, when I have a lamp and I have one lamp that is perfectly functional by definition and another lamp that is a bit quirky, but I really like it because it's just really beautiful. In my daily life, if the job of a lamp is to provide a nice space to work in, for example, then the beautiful lamp is going to work better because I like to use it more. I enjoy handling it. I am more generous with using it. And we also want to bring that into Napkin to make it beautiful. So when you use it, you should have that feeling of it's enjoyable and it works better. And I'm not sure that's true, but when I look at software, it might be a very personal feeling. A lot of software is ergonomically optimized very well. It's easy to understand, easier to understand than Napkin at the beginning, for sure. Still, when I look at it, it all looks very, very similar. Sometimes I don't know which app I'm having open without looking at the title bar. And it's not... giving me that feeling of I like that a lot, and I would love it if we were at the verge of a shift there to say, can we think the same way about the software that we are designing like we think about the houses that we love to live in? We love to live in a space that has a character, that has a deep resonating level of aesthetics. And the comparison is easy. If you, with your team, want to have a very creative time, you are going to a hut in the Alps or maybe a modern art building somewhere at the sea. And you are not going to go to a high-rise building that is having standardized architecture. And to me, a lot of note-taking tools, a lot of other apps are high-rise buildings with standardized architecture. Efficient, powerful, but not the space that I want to spend my time thinking so much.
I love that. I love that. I was actually thinking about a quote by, again, Andy. I read this article of his interview back in 2022, and he was saying it's really an issue of deep collaboration. So in a sense, collective sense making. A lot of the software that is being built today is being designed, again, from this functional utilitarian engineering mindset. And it's not deep enough so that, you know, the users can actually come in and discover the poetry in it and surprise the creator of the software with uses and affordances that the designer themselves had never even imagined. And he said that this is basically, you know, the engineers need to get together with the poets, is what he called them, and the software needs to come out of this deep collaboration. But that's not happening. It's that sort of collaboration isn't not yet common. In talking about beauty, Fabian, Sackmeister recognized that some might have problems with the word beauty, and he said, I love what he said. He said, I would say that for those of us who still have problems with the term beauty, I could also change this to form with intent. I'm curious, what do you think of this phrase, my friend? What do you think is the intent? What is the nature or the quality intent that Sackmeister is pointing to? And then maybe I would love it if you could possibly give us an example of a concrete instance in the evolution of Napkin where you were wrestling with this form with intent.
Great question. The definition is interesting. I mean, Sackmeister is right for sure. So I like what he does, and I think it's cool. And form with intent is an opinionated thing as well. If you are building something into the world, you can either build it in a way that is very flexible and configurable and convenient, or you can have something that is opinionated and that has an intent in different ways. Intent in how it is used, intent in how it makes you feel. And I think that is an important premise for design, and then in the end for beauty as well. The most beautiful things that we can think of probably have a very defined intent. And are we wrestling in Napkin? Yes, a lot. And a very simple example is, and kind of a stupid example as well. We had problems for some time to find a good position for the search and for the account area, kind of those conventional things, because we were always putting them in places where they're not in the way, but then people didn't find them. And then Lorenzo Bruno, who helps us a lot with UX, was in the beginning of our cooperation doing very well-working sketches, kind of just put a sidebar in there and then have a panel coming out of the sidebar and maybe a top bar. And then I understood that he is definitely right. Like, it would probably work better. But in the end, we decided not to do it. Like, we decided to find a different way that is more minimalist and that is, in the end, taking a lot of his input as well, of course, but is having the intent to stay as simple as possible, and also by design force us to stay with this. In the approach that we have chosen now, we are not able to just add another point on the sidebar because it's not there, and I want to continue like that.
I love it. Again, I want to be respectful of your time. We're up on the hour mark. Just as a way to close, Fabian, would love for you to give a little bit of insight into what's next for you. What's next in 2023? I know this call is like your last appointment of the new year to take a much well-deserved rest. What are you looking forward to in addition to growing your team? It sounds like you're developing a mobile app. Tell us a little bit about what's on the roadmap for Napkin and for you.
I mean, also when we're getting towards the end, thank you very much for this opportunity. It was it is a lovable last appointment of the year. Couldn't imagine a better one. apart from user calls are also really, really good, but it's on the same level. And what are we going to do in 2023? We are making the experience more accessible because we see people that are having thousands of thoughts in their account, and we see people really enjoying it a lot, but we also see 50% of the people dropping off the cliff when they are trying to understand what it is and trying to wrap their head around. So we are making it more more accessible. And then the next thing is bringing a native app to Mac, because we think that it's a better experience and even more enjoyable. And the growing the team phase will be very interesting, because that is a limiting factor for other steps that are to follow. And like you mentioned, one of those steps to follow is a mobile app, of course. And there's also going to be some improvement on the AI. So we are getting, like, we are already learning based on what the users are looking at, like what topics they're interested. But I would like to go deeper in this direction as well, to improve the invisible parts of it and to go deeper there.
Amazing. I wish you and your colleagues and David, your co-founder, the best of luck in the new year with all of this. And I thank you, feeling really deep gratitude for you joining me on this talk and wandering with me through all the meandering pathways. I want to thank all of our viewers who are, whether watching this synchronously or asynchronously, for tuning in. You could be doing many things with your time right now, but you're spending this time with us on, I think, conversations that are really deeply needed in this world. So with that, I bid you all farewell. Thank you once again, Fabian, my friend. Really appreciate you.
Caroline, thank you very, very much. Also, thanks to the audience.
Bye-bye. Happy New Year, everyone. Bye-bye.